Lights, camera, action.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Movie Madness in association with Spitballing Pod. I'm Luke Byron, joined this week by Dan Delaney, and today we'll be getting into 2014's American Sniper.
I got a woman and a kid moving towards a convoy. Yeah, she's got a grenade. Did you say it to the kid?
You say a woman and a kid?
You got eyes on this? Can you confirm?
Negative. Your call.
They fry you if you're wrong.
How are we doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm currently sitting 2 meters away from my fan because if I was any closer, you'd hear it. But no, otherwise, I'm all good. On my day off today. So yeah, that's what I've got time to talk about American Sniper.
There we go. Navy SEAL sniper Chris Kyle's pinpoint accuracy saves countless lives on the battlefield and turns him into a legend. Back home with his family after 4 tours of duty, however, Chris finds that it is the war he can't leave behind. I ask this same question every week. What do you think the critics thought of this?
I did a lot of... research on YouTube and people that have quite popular sort of channels that people follow. And hearing what other people think, I would say the overall perception is Bradley Cooper's amazing in it.
Yeah.
But the truth behind the whole story is that's a load of shit. That's not. Yeah. It's dramatized. It's dramatized. Obviously, I mean, it's going to be. It's directed by Clint Eastwood. So... But yeah, a lot of them were saying, a lot of the critics, or some of the stuff I've read, said that the PTSD stuff was not looked into enough. Obviously, you can only have so much time in a film before it drags on and gets a bit boring. But yeah, a lot of it was saying Bradley Cooper's amazing, but a lot of the other characters they could have done more with.
Yeah,
like for me, it would be Mustafa, the opposite. The other sniper.
Yeah.
A little bit more about him because he just showed up and started tearing shit up. But no, a lot of the critics said that Bradley was good. It wasn't as juicy as what it could have been, and not entirely true.
Spielberg was the guy that was initially on to direct, which feels like a polar opposite to Clint Eastwood. Mm. And they kept basically adding and tagging stuff onto the script. And it got to the point where the script they had was going to be about 3 hours long. Spielberg said that's not his type of film. He couldn't do it justice in the way that he would like to. Mm. But the thing he actually brings in is the additional sniper, Mustafa, who we'll get into a little later. So that was his addition to the script. So once Eastwood saw that, he loved it. And I think they say that Spielberg called him personally, basically to say, I'm not going to be doing this anymore. You should probably jump on board and get this done. 5 reviews. Eastwood steers clear of politics. It's not about questioning the mission. It's about the toll the mission takes on victims and survivors alike. Clint Eastwood's sturdy yet simplistic American sniper doesn't really probe the depth of a Navy SEAL who reportedly killed 160 enemies in Iraq. When American Sniper is on the battlefield, it is at its best. Eastwood has a keen sense of pacing for those moments, bringing an intensity that is as great as any film in the genre. To call American Sniper a pro-war movie or an anti-war movie is to miss the point. All war movies are both.
Mm.
I've mentioned that kind of idea on here before to Kieran. I think it's when we did 1917, and I've forgotten the guy's name. It was some French critic from way back, and he essentially explained the paradox that to make an anti-war movie, you need to show war. And if we're tuning in the cinema for an anti-war movie and you show war, unfortunately, as an audience, all we want to see is those gunshots, explosions,
blood and guts
and all of that stuff. So you can't really do an anti-war movie properly because we're drawn to the thing that you're trying to tell us we shouldn't be drawn to.
Yeah, I agree.
Powered by Clint Eastwood's sure-handed direction and a gripping central performance from Bradley Cooper, American Sniper delivers a tense, vivid tribute to its real-life subject. Now, Bradley Cooper, for this, he had to gain over 40 pounds, they say. He ate 6,000 calories a day, which calculates to eating a meal every 55 minutes.
Yep.
He said it wasn't fun consuming those calories, as you can imagine. Most of it was in the form of these horrid protein shakes that he just had to keep chucking down between weightlifting. We always hear a lot about the kind of extremes in these circumstances. So like McConaughey having to lose the weight, was it Jared Leto doing it? Yeah. And then in this case, I don't know which one. I guess the not eating is probably easier. Neither are pleasant, but it's less work than eating more and doing all the work.
I reckon not eating is easier, but then you're also most likely going to be sleep deprived. You have zero energy. You're meant to be playing a part, playing a character in a film, which is probably going to take anywhere between 3 and 6 months to shoot. And you're eating the equivalent, or you're eating like a tin of salmon and an apple a day. Yeah. Like that is not sustainable. I think I'd struggle if I had to lose that kind of weight, but to gain the weight, I can imagine that being just as hard, probably harder, because you're exercising, you're overeating, your shits are probably huge. I mean, fair play to Bradley. How many months did it take him to?
I don't know. I don't know exactly. I know
several.
Me and Kieran did Silver Linings Playbook on here, and so I watched all kinds of Bradley Cooper stuff then, and I read up all about his journey basically to get to where he was, and he reached this point where he just was told by a director that he wasn't good looking enough, which you see how he's received now, and it's mental. But he went through a phase where he was addicted to some drugs during that time, and so for this he refused to take any kind of synthetics or any kind of performance enhancing drugs because he didn't want that in his system again. And so it was probably even harder work than it needed to be. A couple of years back, we went through a phase, and if you'd been in a Christmas film, we'd approached you for an interview, and we spoke to all kinds of different people. And we spoke to the kid from Bad Santa.
Oh, yeah.
And he had probably the perfect version of this, where they paid him, he had to put on 20 pounds in a short period of time, and they basically just funded all of the takeaways that he wanted to eat. And then afterwards funded a personal trainer for him for however long he needed to get at least back to where he was before doing the film. So that's probably the perfect medium between either of what McConaughey or Bradley Cooper had to do here.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, if you're getting paid for that, or you're getting looked after in that sense, then I think, absolutely. I mean, I would definitely tackle it as an actor. I'd love to do it. I did it when I was 19 or 20. I got cast as a soldier, funny enough. I got cast as a soldier, and I was probably around 13 stone at the time. And I'm only 5'8". 5'7", but we'll go with 5'8". just because I didn't want to be that oversized soldier, I lost shit tons of weight during uni, and I was really happy with my physique at the end of it, but I did that by basically starving myself, which looking back on it is fucking stupid. I wouldn't even drink water. My body was because most of my upbringing, I was always oversized. When I was a kid, I was scrawny, but losing that weight and doing it the way I did is not healthy, and it wasn't very nice, but I did it. Now I'm back to 13 stone or whatever, but so I've been through it, but I can't, not to the extent that, Matthew McConaughey, your Bradleys, all that kind of stuff.
I kind of get with some performances doing it to, as much of it, just get yourself in the right headspace. So I imagine Bradley Cooper is walking around with his head slightly higher, he's walking around with his shoulders broader when he's put on all of this weight, all of this muscle, and done all of that. And the other way around
as well.
You're probably shrinking into yourself when you're doing the opposite, but
yeah,
sometimes it must just make you a nightmare to deal with, because if you're essentially weight drained the whole time, you're not going to be a pleasant person to be around. And I imagine if you're bloated all the time and you're knackered and exhausted, you're not very pleasant either. So works probably for the film, but for the process, not ideal.
I mean, I've never actually read or heard any bad press about Bradley.
Literally none.
Yeah, he seems like a really good guy. In his interviews, really genuine. But yeah, I get what you're saying. I mean, who knows? Every other actor that's worked with him, I think, especially on that film, I was watching those interviews, and they all said that he would walk around in character with the accent a lot of the time. But they didn't say he was hard to work around. I mean, a lot of people, I think of Oppenheimer, for example, with Killian. A lot of people say that he is quite, he keeps himself to himself. He doesn't eat, apparently, Cillian Murphy, but he keeps himself to himself, and some people don't find that healthy on set, because you're not interacting, you're not communicating, you're not, you know, having a laugh outside of shooting hours. So, yeah, it swings and roundabouts. But Bradley seems like a good guy. So,
well, there's a difference in there between doing it and kind of being reserved, or using it as an excuse to be an asshole. And
exactly,
that was where all the stories came from about Shia LaBeouf, where he'd basically be an asshole to people, like threatening women on the set of Lawless and all these things, with the excuse of, well, I'm just getting in character. And yeah, that's where I kind of turn my nose at when I see those kind of things. Yeah,
it's like, you don't need to go that far. But I mean, if it helps people get into character, fair play. But yeah, hurting other people's feelings in the process is, there's no excuse. Like Marlon Brando, like we've spoke about it.
Yeah, yeah.
That guy, as talented as he was the biggest tosser when it came to, what was it?
Apocalypse Now.
We were talking about that. And you said that, I think, did you say that he like just hid out in the place for like 3 weeks or three months?
He basically, the whole thing with him being in the shadows and all of that kind of thing, he turned up on set and he was just like grossly overweight. He'd shaved his head. And then basically used the excuse of saying it would be for the character, said he would refuse to do the shoot if they didn't do the kind of putting him in the shadows and all of this stuff. In the end, worked out very well for the film, horrendous to be around, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Bradley Cooper said he was working out 4 hours a day. He was doing twice daily lessons with a vocal coach. He would then finish that and just study hours of footage of Chris Kyle. He would then do military training with an ex-Navy SEAL sniper that worked with Chris Kyle. So
nuts.
He just dived in like head first.
Mm.
He did all of it.
An Oscar for this one.
Yeah, he met Chris Kyle's father shortly after he died, because the process of the film had already started, and then he's killed once it started. And he said like little things, like he was sat at the dining table that Kyle was brought up at, speaking to his dad, getting all this stuff, and he just gave his word to Kyle's father and said, oh, basically I'm going to do him justice. You can't hear it in my voice now, but by the time we get there, I'm going to sound as close of a match as I can physically do. Some level of pressure to put on yourself.
Yeah, and his dad, I read this as well, that his dad basically said to Bradley, he was like, you look nothing like my son. You sound nothing like my son. And my son is three times the size of you. How the hell are you going to pull this off? But, I mean, Bradley did. He clearly did. I mean, the accent is, you could tell he's worked so hard on that. It was flawless. The accent was flawless. It was like he just became Kyle. So, yeah, no, fair play to Brad. So I think he works pretty hard and it paid off.
He literally was given Chris Kyle's walking shoes for the film, and so he was literally walking in his shoes while doing the film. You mentioned doing some acting. I didn't know if you were going to mention it at all, but I thought there was a good comparison. You played young Phil Mitchell on EastEnders last year.
I did.
I saw it was the anniversary on your Instagram story. Now, that's not a real person, obviously, but I think the same sentiment applies, because I'm thinking, how do you take on a character like that, pick up the traits, the voice, and everything else that goes with it not then becoming a parody? Because anytime you do these like texts and accents and all of these things, it can become very quickly that you're like an impersonator rather than becoming the person.
Yeah. So when I first landed the gig, I said to, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Toby, the director. I met him numerous times, sort of in rehearsals and stuff. And I said, Toby, what am I doing here? I get that I somewhat look like him and I can act kind of. And Toby said the last thing we want is an impersonation, especially with a young Phil Mitchell. So when he said that, I was studying Phil for quite a while anyway. And then I thought to myself, it's a character arc. It's a journey. So what we see Phil as now is Phil Mitchell. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But back then he was nothing like that. It's the journey in which he's gone to, or he's had in order to turn into Phil, which is, you know, with the gravelly voice, the stiffness, the deaf stares. He wasn't that when he was a kid, so I felt that was quite important. So when we started filming, and the first scene we did was a dinner scene, which I was so nervous about because I knew it was going to be one of the opening scenes outside of the boxing scene. I didn't know how to portray Phil. I went a bit nuts. Like, I was in my hotel room pacing up and down going, oh my God, I'm not fit for this. I met Steve fortunately right before that shoot where we did the opening scene. And Steve just said, look, the last thing you want to do is impersonate me. Just do what you think is right. And as simple as that is, as advice goes, it really worked in my favor because I was essentially myself, just with a little bit of an accent and a little bit of a bad mood, and just added a protective side, a protective layer where Phil's always looking over his shoulder and glaring at things and holding his stare. So yeah, I pulled it back. I didn't do an impersonation, and that was what I was pretty adamant on not doing. And I feel like it worked.
Well, in terms of it working, I messaged Kieran on the night. I didn't message you. Mm. And I'm sure you would have seen bits after. Mm. If you had done a bad job, the size of that fan base, I think they would have been vocal enough that you wouldn't have been able to avoid hearing it. So the fact that you didn't probably does speak to you doing a good job.
Yeah, I was pretty happy with some of the reviews. Radio Times, shout out, thank you very much. Everyone's comments were great. That whole sort of 2-3 weeks after that episode came out was nuts. It was good.
Well, I know he got to speak to Chris Carr once, I think, and it was about a
fortnight
before he was killed. Maybe he'd have been able to take something from that. I know when Margot Robbie did I, Tonya, she said that she didn't want to meet the character she was portraying, Tonya Harding, I think the name was, because she didn't want to feel any level of sympathy, any level of empathy, whatever, and then have that impact what she'd done. I think it, in some ways, maybe would have benefited Bradley Cooper that the guy was no longer around, but you have the pressure from the family, which we'll get to very shortly. The film opens with Chris Kyle having to make a decision. You've got a child that's now armed with a rocket, and he's asking himself, can he break kind of every kind of moral code within himself and take the shot? For me, that's kind of where the conscience of the film ends, really. I understand being a soldier means being in a certain headspace. If I think of any other war film, either new or old, Hacksaw Ridge is the entire film, but Saving Private Ryan, All Quiet on the Western Front, 1917, Full Metal Jacket, there's at least one moment where they essentially say, look, I'd rather it was them than me, but I still don't feel good about it. This guy has more kills than anyone in recorded history within his field, and he only really blinks if the body belongs to someone under 10 years old. So I guess the question I would ask is, should they force a narrative that maybe isn't there for the purpose of a film when you're taking other liberties? Because by all accounts, Chris Kyle says that he doesn't feel any guilt. He said that in his book. Other than not saving all of his fellow soldiers, he doesn't look at the people he killed as anything other than the enemy, so to speak.
Yeah, I've also, I heard that But in Chris Carl's book, he also says, I shot anything with a turban, which is quite a sickening comment, to be honest. I think they could have done more, and they probably could have been a bit bit more truthful with it all. They painted him out to be this great hero, and yeah, he's a great sniper, but is he a hero? I think there's a fine line there. Everything that I read about Chris Carl sort of suggested that he was a very talented Navy SEAL, and he saved a lot of lives, but he took a lot of lives, and many of those were innocent. So I think, and I think the film could have been more truthful in that sense. I think the first scene, I think that scene itself sets up the film so well. And I love the fact that it cuts you off and then comes back to it. That was a great touch, because it explains the journey and how he got to that moment, that specific moment. And there's another scene where, you know, the kid picks up an RPG.
Yeah, and he puts it down.
So I heard that. I heard, as if I'm in Hollywood. I found something where it said that Clint Eastwood was in that shot. You know where where Bradley's staring down the rifle, the kid's picking up the RPG and he's going, please don't pick it up, put it down. Clint was in the background whispering in Bradley's ear that whole time. That whole shot, he was saying, are you going to kill a kid? Really making him believe it, which I thought was quite interesting. But, I mean, maybe that's how Clint directs, I don't know.
Well, I think Clint Eastwood, in hindsight, was probably the perfect guy for this script.
Agreed.
Because I think both when acting and directing, he's very good with the more simplistic stories. And I don't want that to sound disrespectful. I think he's great at telling us what to think. His stories are very black and white. He doesn't present something on screen that we have to kind of interpret in our own way. Like, the effect of war is maybe the closest thing we have to any kind of message in this. It's grim whenever we're overseas. It's very purposeful. Those scenes, as you said, are very good. It doesn't comment on whether the war in Iraq was a good or bad idea, but then I know Chris Carl was very outspoken that he believes it was a good idea. He has no criticism towards Bush or any of that. He truly does believe in everything that he did. He's very intense, and you see that carry over when they come home. You see, like, the fellow soldier that's killed in a raid, and he returns to the US to attend the funeral. You don't feel at any point that he's particularly conflicted with what he was doing. And when I watched it for the second time at the start of this week, that was the main thing I came away with. Conscience was the first word I wrote down. But then when I did the reading afterwards about who he was, that kind of makes a lot of sense, because it seems that was how he saw himself. But there were just no moments in the film where they kind of asked the question whether he's a hero or like a state-sanctioned murderer, as I saw another headline do it. They kind of pass over that very quickly.
They touch on it. They touch on the PTSD and having a conscience, but they don't go into it enough for me. I think there's a scene. Trying to think, I think there's two scenes that I had in my head. One of them is when his newborn baby is in the hospital. He sees that the nurses are neglecting a crying baby, and he's smacking on the glass, "Tend to my baby now!" and all that. Like, that was a real bit of, so it seemed out of character, because the whole film, his character to that point hadn't really raised his voice. He was quite calm, collected. Didn't have much of a conscience, but that touched on the PTSD. Like, he felt like that baby crying and left alone, sort of in a dark place, you know, just crying your eyes out as you would as a baby, and seeing him react like that, I thought was quite interesting. And then there was another scene where he is sitting in the front room, or he's sitting in the living room, and I think the front of the house, and he's just staring at a blank TV, and the camera does like a 360 or a 180. I thought that was a really clever shot, and I think that touched on PTSD, but the film as a whole, not nearly enough.
I think, when they do deal with it, I think they deal with it as well as anything I've seen outside of The Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
You've got the scene where he's in the bar and he's crying and he says, like, I just needed a moment, basically. I thought it was good that they didn't dial it up too much. They don't kind of cross-cut flashbacks in with it. The sheer nothingness, basically, of him being alone. I saw John Bernthal has a podcast, and I see clips from it all the time, and he had a veteran on there, and they said that this film was the best depiction of PTSD that they'd seen, and he said that scene of him at home just staring at the TV brought him to tears because it just felt so real. And I think you see it more through his wife, played by Sienna Miller. She's fantastic. Many times she does say, you know, you're changing, and it's if we get that that's happening, but
yeah,
it's very good. In his autobiography, he does quite clearly say, as we said, the PTSD that he has, I think he described as minimal. He saw really as just him protecting his fellow soldiers. It wasn't the fact that he'd killed people. It was the fact that he'd been in danger so many times. He'd seen his comrades die. It wasn't that he was troubled by killing so many people.
It could just be a brave face. It could just, you know, anyone can say that, but behind closed doors, when you're in a room by yourself, I mean, he could have the snap, crackle and pop in his head when he's sleeping. You just don't know, but some people don't talk about it. PTSD is quite a, I think it's, we're still learning about it every day. And I think the real, obviously the people that suffer with that shit, coming back from sort of war-torn countries, I mean, no one really knows what goes on in their heads. It's just what they tell us. And I think it's a good example of Chris Carr, which is he said that, yeah, his PTSD was minimal, but behind closed doors, you just don't know. And I think that's good in the film because it doesn't... So with Chris Carr, there wasn't much talk of PTSD, as you've said, but in the film, there isn't much PTSD, which is, I suppose, looking back on it, now having this conversation, is actually quite a good movie choice for me. I quite enjoy watching PTSD, like Jarhead.
Yeah.
For example, I thought some of the stuff there was brilliant. And the same with Hurt Locker as well. I think maybe not having too much PTSD in this film was actually quite a good film choice. But yeah, I don't know what you think.
Maybe the person that actually presented it the best in one scene was when you see his brother, who's really like fun loving and animated the whole rest of the film. Yes, and then you see him in one scene, and he's just been broken by it, and he's having to go back.
Yeah.
So that was as good as anything.
That was. And it wasn't, they didn't drag it out. It was that's probably like a minute shot.
I'd have liked them to go back to him, and we never do.
That's another character that they could have explored
more. Yeah.
I mean, that guy, I think I've only ever seen that guy in like one film, which was it the Mole Cop?
He's in another film with Bradley Cooper. He plays the younger brother in Wedding Crashers.
Yes, he does. He plays the weirdo. Oh my God. Oh, that's funny. It's funny, but he was good. I like the part he played, but that's probably something that I would say I would have wanted to see more is definitely him and what he went through. But obviously the big story, the big main guy is Chris Carr, so they can't do too much, I suppose.
Yeah. So he was actually 25 years old when he joined the Navy, so they ham up the call him an old man. I saw...
At 30, yeah.
The thing that caught me off guard the most, given something I'll get into later, he never actually shot any children. In his autobiography, he explains that he scoped a child at one point, which is depicted in the film with the RPG scene.
Yep.
He said he didn't fire. He wasn't going to kill a kid, innocent or not. He said, I'll have to wait until the savage who put him up to it showed himself on the street. So it's strange that, I'll mention later, they had a lot of influence, his family, that kind of gets passed when they didn't allow some other things to be in there. Very strange, because you'd think that's about as far as you can get.
Shooting a kid in the chest. I mean,
I guess maybe it's to just set up the moral compass of the film, because he aims the scope and shoots a woman and a child.
In
the first kills he has, and it's probably setting your marker out, so to speak.
It hooks the audience in, doesn't it? Because it's this controversial. Yeah. So
anything goes at that stage as
exactly,
well.
Exactly. And then once you've seen that he shot the kid and I think it's a good scene. It's a good scene. It sort of helps people stay interested then, because you wonder what he's going to be killing next and how he's going to do it. And yeah.
Yeah. The scenes of him growing up do feel very Eastwood, very classic, typical, very classic American, you know, the speech about the sheep and the wolf and
Springfield rifle and some crappy little scope.
You could a lot of those opening scenes, you could play like the Team America theme over the top of it and it would just fit perfectly. Yeah. Did you like the training scenes? Because you get a lot of these. They're almost like a Rocky training sequence at this point. We've seen them all before, but I thought they were fun. They made them as interesting as they could in this point.
Yeah, and they were funny as well.
I don't know how almost any of that stuff helps you when you get into war, by the way.
Nah.
Just lying and letting the waves crash into you. Yeah.
I remember thinking that yesterday. It's a bit of a random one, but they probably do it.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they'd probably do all kinds of stuff. But for me, that whole training sort of sequence that they put together, it wasn't long enough because it felt like he jumped from talking to this guy about joining the army. 5 minutes later, he's at the end of his training program and he's about to become a Navy SEAL. So I think the whole training montage wasn't long enough. I would have wanted to see more of his journey sort of getting into the army, but... Yeah,
his first tour, he isn't even a qualified sniper.
No.
It's his second tour, so yeah. I guess at 2 hours 15 already, they probably, when they're looking through at what they could cut, that probably felt more cuttable than anything else.
There could be so much more footage that we just... Yeah. Footage, but yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I get what you mean. I like the soundtrack they used again on, let's say, the completed opening scene when we get the part two of it, when... It's very loud with the tanks at first, and then we just get almost like pounding heartbeat soundtrack in to start it. Then it shifts to just his breath, and then it's just pure silence as the bullet flies and the two bodies just left in the dirt. Yeah. There's no slow motion there. That's reserved when the missile fires in another scene later. But we get both sides with his partner saying, I think he says how gnarly it is, and celebrating while Cooper says to get off him.
Yeah,
but then by the evening... He's talking casually about it as his friend's reading The Punisher. It's very good versus evil in this film. Like, that's how they see it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the guy. I like his sort of his wingman. What's his name? Is it Mark? Or what's the...
Yeah, he's got a couple. There's one that's Riggs or something like that. And then there's the other one. Is it Mark or Martin or something like that?
I like the difference in them two, especially in that first scene, because you've got a guy who's saying gnarly and it seems like a very young guy, and then you've got Bradley, which is polar opposite, sort of just giving this death stare down the scope, sort of assessing a situation, telling him to shut up and get the fuck off him after he's shot mum and kid. That was a good. It was quite a nice, shot just to see the two different kind of soldiers. Do you know what I mean by that?
Like, yeah.
One of them's clearly a Navy SEAL. You know, it's kill or be killed, and the other guy's like, I just want to fucking survive out here. That's all I care about.
Yeah. So Chris Kyle is credited as helping with the screenplay. I know that his dad has some involvement later in the production, as does his wife. That's always. It's always a red flag to me when I see a biopic, and it's the issue I still have with the Straight Outta Compton one is that when Dre and Ice Cube are producing and helping with the screenplay, you're only seeing it from one perspective, and it can be a bit skewed in that sense that you aren't going to go against them. I do wonder if any changes would have been made without their involvement, but I don't know how much of the story they could have told without his book, so I can kind of see the predicament they were in.
Yeah, I agree.
Bradley Cooper in particular, this is some of the best acting that he's ever done here. Mm-hmm. Only the 10th actor to land 3 consecutive Oscar nominations. He had American Hustle, Silver Linings Playbook, and this back to back to back. He does a really good job at feeling like a dangerous guy. He doesn't come across as a malicious one here. You never feel like he's going to hit his wife when he gets angry. You never feel like he's going to flip out on any of his soldiers that are alongside him. But then he also doesn't come across as boring either. It's a very delicate line that he manages to do, and he obviously does it very well.
I felt like it was quite nice to see, to be honest. He was just sort of the ultimate alpha male, but yeah, like you say, there was not much aggression there. He was cool, calm, collected, but at the same time, a lot of people associate those kind of people as the most dangerous people. Like you said, he played it so well. Like, he's a very, very watchable actor, but to see him take on that role, Yeah, it was brilliant. Because if you look at that role in contrast to American Hustle, or what was the other one you referenced?
Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's probably his best.
They're chaotic characters. And then he goes from chaotic to death stare, you know, absolute fucking beast. It just shows how talented he is.
I think he's got Limitless the year before that as well. So he goes Limitless, Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle,
yeah,
and then American Sniper, just a ridiculous run.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's getting cast in these films for a good reason. He's clearly a very, very good actor, and he's very watchable. I look forward to his next one. I don't know what he's got coming out.
So he likes doing the directing now. So I know he does a lot of that. He's obviously probably supplementing that with the Marvel checks, but he's doing that film. Oh, he was in the press recently. He's playing.
He did a famous Broadway as well.
Yeah, he goes straight off this film, and he has to lose a ton of weight to go and play John Merrick in The Elephant Man. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
His body is just screaming.
Yeah.
Did you see Dungeons and Dragons?
It's not really my cup of tea. It's not, yeah.
He has like a 2-minute scene in there that he didn't get credited for. Mm. And so I wasn't going to see it. And then all the reviews were like really good. Yeah, he like steals the film in like 2 minutes, mostly because it was a surprise.
I like surprises. What was the film that I watched? It's like Oppenheimer. There's so many surprises in that film in terms of castings. Like what's his name? Josh Peck just comes out of nowhere. And obviously he played such a large sort of role in Disney for so long. Everyone just associates
Nickelodeon,
Nickelodeon, sorry. It was actually quite nice to see him in that, though, because I thought he did a good job. But and the same with Barbie, like John Cena.
I've not seen that, but I will watch it.
You should. It is a good film. It is a good film.
Kieran said you preferred it to Oppenheimer, but I don't know if that was accurate or not. May have been setting you up for a fall.
No, I watched Oppenheimer again 2 weeks ago.
I wish I'd seen it in IMAX.
Yeah, mate. It's a great film, and it is a good watch. You've really got to pay attention, and I think you need to know a little bit about Oppenheimer before you go and see it and the story. But no, I don't know. I think I preferred Oppenheimer, but Barbie, when I watched it, I did come out of the cinema thinking that was better than Oppenheimer. I enjoyed that more as an audience member. I nearly came out crying. Literally, I nearly came out crying from Barbie.
Blimey.
Yeah, mate, you'll understand when you watch it. I can't say too much just because that's a spoiler. But
I know what you mean, though, with the spotting of the actors. The one that caught me that likely won't mean a lot to you was Josh Zuckerman, who was in Sex Drive that came out in 2008, which is a film that a couple of us just really love. It was the first film that we did on here, actually.
Mm.
And seeing him, we spoke to him a couple of years back during COVID, and I saw his face, like, is that him? And I had to do the brightness down on IMDb and have a sneaky look, just because it was going to bug me the whole film otherwise. But I love seeing Benny Safdie in there as well. I can't wait to see whatever they do next. Yeah, when I saw beforehand, every other day it was like such and such confirmed to be an Oppenheimer, confirmed. I thought it's going to be a mess, and then it's perfect when Gary Oldman comes in late. Yeah, ridiculously good. For the casting of Taya, his wife in this, Kate Mara, Evangeline Lilly, they were both preferable choices to Sienna Miller. Kate Mara chooses to do Fantastic Four instead, which flopped in 2015. Evangeline Lilly chooses to do Ant-Man instead, which she's got 3-4 films out of, so probably the right decision for her. Sienna Miller, she does this and she does Foxcatcher in the same year, if you ever watch that.
Yeah, Foxcatcher. Yeah. I love the documentary. Yeah. I prefer the documentary over the film, but the film itself, still a good watch. I just think the prosthetics on what's-his-face.
Steve Carell?
That was a little bit whack. They could have probably cast someone else, even though I think Steve Carell's really good in it. Prosthetics just for me weren't believable. You could see it was makeup, and
I don't know if you noticed in this, it's a plastic baby that they use in the scenes. The baby isn't real.
No. And
now I've told you that, if you see any of the scenes again, it's so obvious.
Oh, fuck.
Basically, the baby they were going to use got sick, and the backup that they had was a twin of the baby, so they were both sick. And whether it was schedule, whether it was saving money or whatever, they just chose to use a plastic baby. And Bradley Cooper himself came out after him and was like, yeah, that was ridiculous. I don't know why we did that. But I didn't notice it and, until I saw it. And then, yeah, it's really bad.
That's ruined it for me now. It's like...
There has to be someone on that set had a baby.
Yeah.
That they could have just like bring a kid to work there.
It's just a genuine fuck up. Like they haven't, they didn't prepare for that to happen. I mean, babies get ill all the time, but yeah, no, that's not nice. I really want to rewatch those scenes now.
Taya said that she thought Sandra Bullock should play her. So she was shooting high, as she felt that they had a lot of relatability between them. She thought Sienna Miller was probably too British, but after meeting with her, she said that she could accept the choice. We've seen before, usually in a biopic, if the lead is still alive, the person that gets cast in their place is usually considerably better looking than them.
Yeah.
What's Jordan Belfort getting Leo casting him? He probably couldn't believe his luck when he had that. It's just insane.
I felt like Sienna did a really good job.
I think with another person doing this and with another screenplay, it could have been just a very typical wife of a soldier role. And she squeezes, like, I don't think she could have squeezed any more out of the role.
No. With what she had in the script, I felt she was good. And I sort of finished the film wanting to know more about her, because it's when he comes home that you see her and you see her struggles. But I did like when I think he's on the phone. He's on the phone and they're in the truck and he's like, "Hey, babe, how are you?" And then and she's walking out of the hospital. He's just revealed that it's a boy. And then all of a sudden chaos just comes out of nowhere. And her acting in that moment, for me, I love that. And it's so real. It's so real. That thing, that sort of feeling that she would have gone through there, is it happens all the time. You're on the phone call and your husband says, "Oh, sorry, babe, I've got to go," and then you hear all this chaos. It probably happens all the time. So yeah, I felt like Sienna was fantastic.
In contrast, I do think she has the worst moment of acting in the entire film, and it's when 9/11 is happening on the TV and you hear her say, "Chris, no," and then he comes back in.
Didn't even clock that. I mean, I think she's fit, so I mean, maybe I'm sort of...
been charmed.
I have, yeah. I liked her sort of entrance into the film with telling the guy to fuck off because she saw him take his wedding ring off. I don't know, I liked what she brought.
Yeah, no, she's very good. It was literally that one moment I clocked, but some of the notes I took down as an offence... Sorry.
Yeah, can I go on?
I was going to say, as a completely separate thing at the start, as an insult, where someone gets called a big Dr. Pepper Cheeto eating motherfucker. And I thought that could describe me quite easily. So it's with her character, it comes across well that you see she likes the kind of determination and the structure and the life that she gets to live in a sense of the family that she has because of probably how the traits that he has through his military work. But then at the same time, you see her slowly getting dragged down by everything else that's to do with it. She seems to take it as kind of an annoyance at the start. And then by the end, where she's telling him, like, "We're not going to be here when you get back. I'm making these memories on my own." And all of these about how difficult it is, the stress she's going through. I was glad that she didn't lose the baby in that scene, because I was convinced that was where it was going, first of all. When you see that usually, and it's the stress and all of these things. Her best scene is probably when the mother reads out the letter from the soldier that has died, and they get back in the car, and she basically wants Chris's response to that because she identifies with how the mother's feeling, and he basically says that the letter was what killed him, just completely stone-faced, and you're kind of waiting for her to say something back. I think they could have written something for her character to say back, but the fact she doesn't know how to respond, we don't know how to take that either. And so it goes down very well in a scene where she really doesn't really have to do much on paper.
It's really clever. I think it's really, really clever. Whether that was a directorial choice from Clint, I mean, who knows? It could just be the editing, but yeah, that I think that played really, really well. Yeah, I think it shows how difficult sort of the communication might have been between them two after he came back. But yeah, I still think that she was the right person. I wrote down that another person that I could see playing her role was Rachel McAdams. But then again, she's done you know, like Southpaw. She was the wife in that.
She's great.
I mean, she's fantastic, but she's done so many sort of wife roles, classic wife roles, that I just don't know whether I'd believe it.
If I saw a bit of full-on Wedding Crashers reunion issues back in there as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, actually, I didn't think of that. That's so true.
It feels so strange that when we have got past the initial sniper scenes at first, we get this like phase where he spends the middle portion of the film just avoiding doing that. Just he's on the ground. It's like when you see like an MMA, like a wrestler that isn't happy with decisions anymore and he wants to feel the knockouts, or it's like us subbing Saliba off for the last the middle of a game, just putting him up front.
Yeah,
they're just left so much more exposed. I don't know what the thinking is, if that was reality or not. You've got this guy that is the best in the world at his job, and you suddenly just stick him on the ground doing raids and going in and out of buildings. It's so strange.
Yeah, I kind of like it though, because
it's good for the film. It makes no sense.
Yeah, and it probably is true though. I mean, I'm sure I've seen stuff of him just saying he would stay in a building for 6, 7, 8 hours at a time, either by himself or with his team. But you can imagine how boring that would be when you're literally staring at stones and thinking.
That's what
that
I mean. He just gets amongst it, doesn't he?
Yeah, he just gets bored. Just gets bored and just says, "Do you know what? Fuck it. I'm going down there. This is boring. I'll see you guys in a couple of hours." But then again, he's a Navy SEAL. He's the toughest of the toughest. So, I mean, to have him in your midst when you're raiding buildings, like, I'm sure that was a thing, and I'm sure they were like, "Oh, we're going to be fine. We got Chris Paul." Yeah.
Well, because a sniper is like the modern day equivalent of the archer in like old films or fantasy films. Mm. People usually thought they were the coolest characters. Everyone loves Legolas in Lord of the Rings. Never my favorite, but the sniper, you'd think, stand back. Like his mate says, "I'm not going down there unless I have to. Stay out of here, out of the way." It's just.
I think it's them sort of portraying Chris Kyle as the ultimate soldier. He's not just a sniper. He can do it all. So I liked how it switched it up a bit.
Oh, for sure, it's fun for the film.
Yeah. I think it would have been probably a bit boring as an audience member if it was just him in towers, camping out in the middle of nowhere in someone's bathroom, staring through a crack in the wall. So I think it was a good element for the film.
So we referenced it earlier. Around this point, they feel the need to create like a face for the bad guy. They can't use Saddam, so they make this butcher.
Mm.
I'd enjoy a film a lot more if it was just 2 hours of them just tracking down Lisandro Martinez and he just gets chopped down at the end. But I wonder, they do that obviously because so many of these other guys are faceless. I think they need to produce some kind of evil that we can identify, because at this point we're just told everyone's evil and he just takes them out from range. And so they create this kind of mythical character by giving him a nickname, by the terror that's kind of inflicted in these civilians that are left behind. And it works. That character, whether he was real or not, I think gets a page in Chris Kyle's book. But for the purpose of the film, it's this guy that no matter how many times he goes home and comes back, he's still out there. And he's slowly taking out his friends and the people that they're trying to trust to get help with. So it works out for the best. I don't know how they would have done that otherwise. They probably would have had to have more of an emotional arc, but this keeps with the good versus evil theme.
Yeah. The butcher wasn't in it enough for me. It was, again, just a good element for the film, but it was quite short-lived, the butcher's story. There was sort of two bad guys, wasn't there? There was Mustafa, the enemy sniper.
Yeah.
But there wasn't enough sort of story about the butcher and how he came to prominence. But I guess at the same time, it can't be a 5-hour film. So they crammed it all in and it did all make sense. But yeah, for me, Mustafa and the butcher, I would have liked to see just a little bit more about them. Whether that be just 10 minutes of them going through sort of similar things to what Chris Carr would have gone through. You know, he might be shooting a Marine one day and then goes back to his family, has dinner. I love stuff like that, seeing two different sides to a character. And I feel like we just saw pure evil with the Butcher and Mustafa. So seeing sort of similar elements to Chris Carr would have been quite nice as well. But yeah, like I said, you know, 2-hour film, you can't really get much more in.
I wonder if what the thought process was with Eastwood, because we don't properly see the Butcher take out that guy's son, but we see Chris Carr doing it. And you would think with the way the whole film's framed, we would see that the other way around. So even though Chris Carr shoots that kid at the start, that would cut away. Instead, they do it with the cutaway of taking out this kid, and then we see him take out the dad immediately after. I don't know if it's just the range of it, like it's easier to frame it from range. It doesn't feel as brutal. I don't know how it works with the certificates and just how palatable it is for the audience. It just felt a weird choice.
Yeah, they probably had to be so careful with that shot. I mean, it's pretty gruesome what's happening. I think they did it probably did it to the best that they.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying all this, but then Saw is still a thing, and it's they just a new made one a new out
a few
one.
Weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like
Saw
I
10.
Don't know. Yeah. Oh, mate, I don't really like him. I've
watched all of them, to be fair. I think we've done one of them on here years ago, but it wasn't with Kieran.
I mean, they're all right. They're all right. I mean, it's always cool to watch gory shit, but yeah, I'd say they probably had to be so careful not to...
I know, I think it's just different from that range, isn't it?
Yeah.
With him being that close. It feels a lot more brutal.
Yeah.
And maybe it feels needless at that stage. If they need it to drive home a point with Chris Carr, a second one feels like, do we need to see all of this?
Yeah, I agree.
I wondered what your impression was. I wasn't a huge fan of the way that the other sniper is eventually taken out with the slow motion with it. It gives the impression, for one, that was kind of the end game for him, when we know that his real battles are kind of still left to come.
Yep.
But also, it just felt very video gamey to me. It hit so much harder with his first kills, where it was so short and snappy.
Yeah.
This one, because you almost have like a POV shot with the bullet hurtling towards the guy, like he's going to have clocked it. It was just a bit weird.
It was rushed. It looked rushed.
It looks like it bounces off his head.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but you can't even see him through the scope. And I mean, I don't know. I didn't believe that kill.
No.
To be totally honest with you, like I think the sniping scenes in what's it called, Enemy at the Gates, I think they're way more believable than that killing.
That one wasn't good.
Yeah, it was rushed. That's what it looked like. I wanted there to be more sort of teasing each other from, you know, however many yards out, and then finally, you know, Chris gets the upper hand. Whereas it sort of seemed. Yeah, it was rushed for me. I think an extra couple of minutes of sort of toying with each other would have been nice. And then, the kill itself and the slow motion, a little bit wanky, for me.
All the rest of it is just right. Like the flashes of violence are impactful because they're so few and far between.
Mm.
It's very...
There's a good balance in that.
It hits us when someone dies on the kind of American side, because there's only, I think, two or three of them maybe.
Yeah.
The actual ending, so the real Chris Carr is murdered on February 2nd, 2013 at a shooting range. He's trying to help a veteran who was reportedly had psychiatric problems and PTSD. The script originally included a reenactment of what happened on that day. This was going to happen just before the funeral scene, but it was vetoed by his wife, as it was too harrowing for her, and she said it'd be too gruesome to have it shown to her children. I understand their perspective. I would think this film isn't made for them. Oh, that sounds horrible to say. It just feels like the decision not to show it takes away from what we've been building up to the whole film. If the whole film is a message about how PTSD affects a person, then what better way to add kind of credence to that than that ultimately being what gets the better of him? It felt like, so we have the shot of him at a shooting range with a veteran, we have the shot of him walking back in the house with his pistol drawn when he's speaking to his wife. it feels like there's a lot of assumption that we know the story, and so they play on that rather than for most people who know nothing. It felt like, it would have been a weird way to do it, admittedly. I feel there was just maybe a better way it could have been done.
Yeah, it's a hard one because, like you said, when they started filming?
So I think they were in. I think they were in production. So he's already he's already learning who Chris Kyle is in short way through.
If they had made this film 5 years after that, then
for sure, I agree with you.
It would have been a different story. But it was probably. I mean, imagine like your partner being shot in the head, killed, and then only a year later. You've got the director coming to you saying, "Oh, we're going to do this scene where you're."
So that's what I was saying before about getting the family involved is a weird way to do it. Do you think?
But they have to be so careful because they're telling someone else's story.
Yeah, but if they've already got the rights to his book, then do you think they maybe? I understand why they did it. Do you think it? You maybe don't have the same leg to stand on when you've been so brutal and so blasé about 160 other people that have been gunned down in the film. That maybe this one feels like.
When you put it like that, I think that, it would have been nice for a different ending. I still think it's done really well, where you don't get too much.
Cut to black,
sort of, yeah. You're left sort of wondering how exactly did that go down.
So do you think even like the build up to it? I know the last text Chris Kyle sent is this guy is nuts. And the guy that also gets killed at the range with him. Text back, I agree, watch my six. You could even have done it so we see that moment. There's the guy that eventually kills him. He's kind of acting up in the car and you see those texts exchanged and then they get to the range and then it kind of fades to black. It was just, I felt there's a lot of ways they could have done it this way. Felt like it was an afterthought almost.
Yeah, I think... Just trying to think how.
I don't think they were ever going to show him getting six bullets put in his back and Bradley Cooper bleeding out on the floor.
Was that actually what happened?
Yeah, he gets like six bullets. He's like, it goes through his spine and his, it's mental.
Okay, now I thought it was just going to be like the classic one bullet in the head.
No, which I thought until I did the reading today on my lunch, actually.
Wow, that guy's still in jail, right?
Yeah, he pleads insanity and doesn't get it.
Crazy. Yeah, I don't know. I would have liked to see a different ending, or if, it would have been cool if they did like a I Am Legend. You know, we get like an alternative.
Yeah,
that would have been cool. But again, it's just a fine line they would be crossing without the family's consent. So
I remember sitting through the whole Daniel Day-Lewis is Lincoln, and you get to the end and you don't see Lincoln get killed either. And I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, that's
you see him in like the theater and he leaves and he doesn't get killed. I thought there was maybe a medium they could have got to.
I think like I said, I mean, they did probably as much as they could without pushing the boundaries, and I feel like, you know, you've got humans here with genuine feelings, so they probably had to protect them as much as possible and tell a good story at the same time. So I reckon they did the best with what they could. It just, it would have been nice, I agree with you, to see a different story, different side to it. But yeah, it's what it is.
Yeah, just I thought the real story was a nice summary of what the film seems to stand for. But the way the credits are done were really good. I remember in the cinema, it was just like complete silence.
Yeah.
And I'm quite glad our cinemas outside of Marvel films, which seems to be creeping in, we don't get the applauses and things like that during films, which I'm very happy about. But I know in America it had the same response, which is a big thing because they love clapping at the end of films over there and during, which is a strange thing.
I liked the choice to use the genuine sort of archival footage.
And pure silence with it as well.
Yeah. It's so powerful. So powerful. And I love that in films when it's, I love true story films anyway, but when they use genuine, like, I wish I could tell you, but you haven't seen it yet. I won't go into that. Barbie.
Oh yeah.
There's an ending to that film that uses real footage, which you'll get why I'm referencing it now.
I think I know what it is, but there's people listening that might not.
Yeah. But that's why I'm not going to say too much. But I like the ending to the film. I thought it was quite powerful. Finished it on a sort of a nice note, because it was clearly a big, big ceremony, and it was a nice sort of send off for, you know, an American hero. Saved a lot of lives, but killed a lot of people at the same time.
Because I
just
thought,
the ultimate badass.
I thought on a rewatch as well that I thought the point they were going to make a big thing of and be like a realization for Kyle was, on his last tour, he gets caught outside the truck, doesn't he? And they essentially drive on without him before he has a chance to get in the back. And I thought a big thing was going to be that he'd sacrificed so much. He tells you all through the film, I'd lay down my life for my country. And it would feel like they turned their back on him when he needed it. But they don't really do much with that. We have the guy telling his son that he's a hero and all these little things in there that go well. Him going for the dog, which was a mad scene in there.
Yeah.
It's like we did Godfather 3 last week, where the whole thing is Michael Corleone wants to give the power up, but he doesn't want to give the power up. And that's basically what is happening with Chris Kyle this whole film. Even when he's back, he still wants that, I guess, the prestige that comes with everything that he does.
Yeah, I liked the bit in the film where he's in the garage. He's in a mechanics workshop with his little one, and there's a guy, a guy comes up to him and says, "You saved my life. Thank you so much. Yeah. You're a legend. You're a hero." And Bradley plays that so well, because Chris doesn't want the title hero, because he clearly just sees his job as his job.
Yeah.
He's nothing special. It's what he is paid and told to do, is to kill moving targets that would try and kill him or his colleagues. So, yeah, it's a good film. It's a good film. It's not the best, but it was definitely a good watch.
Yeah, there's a bit of a narrative, and even with all the things we've said, I still enjoyed the film. It's still a good film. There was some, certainly around the time of it being released and online now, that tries to tell you it's not a good film. It's still a good film. It's just I think there's some discussion to have around it.
Yeah, it's quite a touchy one, because it's a true story, and people's feelings have been hurt, and those people are still around, still alive, you know, his wife, for example, his kids. So opinions, everyone's going to have an opinion of film, of course, but when it's a true story and how a film is played out, and sort of people like us sort of picking it apart, saying, oh, they could have done this differently, I suppose you've got to look on the other side and just think, how would you feel if someone else was talking about your life and your story? I don't know.
I don't think they'd be getting Bradley Cooper to play me.
Yeah, that's funny.
All right, let's close this out. We'll do the awards. I feel like MVP and star of the film are fairly wrapped up. Chris Kyle is undisputedly the MVP, and Bradley Cooper is undisputedly the star of the film. What was the best scene or the best moment in the film for you?
I reckon my brain's not. I think I noted this down.
Is the first kill for me.
Yeah, I think the opening scene, it sets it so, so well. It sort of gives us an idea on what to expect. He's so ruthless. He's just killed a mother and child, and he has saved his colleagues, and that is sort of the moral of the story. That's what he did. He just, within seconds, quite cold-heartedly, just destroyed a family. And then, I don't know. The opening scene is probably the best for me.
Best quote, I think my favorite was the one I said, which is big Dr. Pepper Cheeto eating motherfucker. The one that stood out to me, that I always hate in these films, is his wife says, "You have to make it back to us," as if he has any other plan in that instance other than to get back. Like he was undecided until she said that. I don't know if there was any particular quote that jumped out to you.
There was, because it just made me laugh. It was in the... It wasn't said by Chris Kyle. It was... There's a guy when they're doing the Navy SEAL training, and I can't remember what the drill sergeant says to this guy, but he's like, "Are you still black?" Or something like that. And the guy just goes, "It's all right, sir. I'm not black. I'm the new black. We run slow, we jump low, and we shop a gap. I make folk proud on the ladies. I dick them down.
And like straight after really the other guy's me. Saying, his balls are now up inside him. Bradley Cooper said about how old he is. Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah, that was for me. That was it. It was quite nice to see a playful side to the film. It made me laugh, and that's why I've got it down as a quote. It was good.
That type of training would not work for me. The kind of try and break someone and when they don't,
I'd probably end up smacking someone though.
I'd tap out like that other guy, and they abuse him for it, but hey, you take it on the chin. Would you rather add Brendan Fraser, Miles Teller, or Bill Murray to this movie?
Miles Teller. I like Miles Teller as an actor. I like watching him.
That's one of the squadron alongside him, his brother.
So yeah, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, what's the guy's name? Mark, his right hand man that you get at the start of the film.
Yeah.
When he's scoping down that kid and the lady. Yeah. For me, Miles Teller would be sort of the ideal replacement. I can't imagine Brendan Fraser or what's the other guy?
Bill Murray. You could squeeze Bill Murray in there as his dad, maybe. But
yeah,
I agree on the Miles Teller show.
Yeah, I just think Brendan Fraser at that time probably wasn't doing an awful lot. It would have been a bit random. And then Bill Murray, I don't know. Bill Murray could have been a drill sergeant. It could have been a really short stint.
He could have been really the guy cracking wise at them when they're in the water and all them things.
Yeah, but I think Miles Teller is probably the most appropriate.
And last question, I think you've already given your answer to this. If you had to make a spin-off movie about a side character in a film, who would it be about? You wanted some more Mustafa.
I did, yeah. I want the other side story and how he got to that point where he was sort of dependent, or the sort of the Taliban were dependent on him to expose the enemy and take out the enemy. Yeah, I think it would have been a nice change.
And that one would end well with a cut to black.
Well, yeah. I mean, whether it would do so well in American cinema, but yeah. I don't know. I just felt they should have added more about him. But like I said, 2-hour film, you can only cram him so much.
I thought you could do one with his eventual killer and the subsequent trial. People love trial in a courtroom film these days, so that would go down well.
Mm.
All right. That brings us to an end here. Next week, I've got Troy on. We're going back to Pacino. We're doing Any Given Sunday. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me today, Dan.
No worries, mate.
We'll be back Monday for regular. Talk about Arsenal's return to the Champions League.
Oh, very exciting.
See you next time. Adios.
Adios.